You are listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
Welcome to Sunday. We have a big report today into the evidence that's persuaded some campaigners and lawyers that the Jehovah's Witnesses in this country should be investigated by the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse.
Child abuse is not an epidemic. It's a pandemic. It's everywhere. So what can we do to bring the transparency to these organizations to achieve a goal of protecting children? You know, what can we do now?
Also in the programme, the Pope in Egypt. Our religious affairs correspondent travelled with him and will join us live. Plus, why this has set off a furious debate about the place of religion in Indian life. And 500 years after the beginning of the Reformation, the part music played in the revolution that split the church. The traditionalist Anglican organisation known as GAFCON, the Global Anglican Future Conference, have announced in the last few minutes that they are consecrating what they call a missionary bishop to look after like-minded Anglicans in Britain. The decision was taken at a meeting in Nigeria. Jonathan Peter is the religion correspondent for The Mail on Sunday and has been covering the developments in this area for some time. Morning, Jonathan.
Good morning.
This move has been sort of talked about for some weeks, hasn't it?
It has been in the air for some time, but it was not expected necessarily to take place at this meeting. But the Conservative bishops and archbishops fear that there could be a split in Scotland, the liberal branch of Anglicanism in Scotland, very shortly, because in June, their General Synod, they will expected to vote for allowing same-sex marriages to go ahead in Anglican churches. And there's likely to be parishes splitting away as a result. So the Conservative archbishops have decided to create this missionary bishop, partly to cope with the outcome of that.
It's pretty provocative, isn't it? After all, the Archbishop of Canterbury is, in theory, head of the Worldwide Anglican Communion, and a new bishop is being, well, I suppose, sent to poach on his territory, really.
It will be seen as provocative by many people, because it will be seen as archbishops from abroad intervening in a high-profile way in another part of the Anglican Church. And the Archbishop, as you say, he's the first among equals in the Anglican Church. So it will be seen as a challenge to his authority as well. But he makes his job more difficult, certainly, trying to keep all the factions together when the tensions are increasingly heightened.
And we don't yet know who he will be, assuming there will be a he, or indeed what he'll do and how he'll operate.
That's right. There has been speculation that someone called Canon Andy Lines, who is already the chair of the GAFCON UK organisation in this country, could be a candidate. Some have even mentioned the former Bishop of Rochester, Michael Nazirali. It's not known, however, who will take up the mantle, but they will probably be consecrated in Africa and then come back to this country. At the moment, they won't necessarily pull the nuclear trigger, as it were, by actually going into a Church of England parish and confirming children or something like that. They will probably stand by waiting to see how the situation develops.
And what's your sense about that? Do you think this will have, as they say, traction? Do you think parishes will sign up and join, or individual members of Church of England or the Church of Scotland will?
I think that there are already a number of parishes who have effectively left the structures of the Church of England. They call themselves still Anglicans, but they can no longer feel they can stay within the structures of the diocese, etc. And that those parishes will be ministered to by this new bishop immediately. Others may be tempted then to split off themselves And at one point, there may be a breakdown so bad that this bishop will end up going into existing parishes within the Church of England.
And at the, I suppose, I'd say the other end of the story, in a way, that the first Church of England vicar who married his gay partner, Andrew Forshaw Kane, is leaving the church, he said, and giving some fairly dire warnings about Church of England's attitude on these questions.
Yes, well, that just shows the depth of divisions. On the one hand, the Conservatives are saying to Justin Welby, you're allowing the Church of England to drift too far towards a liberal view. On the other, liberals are saying the church is homophobic and completely out of step with the rest of society. And this is the sort of tensions that that the Archbishop has to deal with.
Jonathan Peter, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning.
No worries, thank you.
In India, a public controversy has blown up about the way mosques and temples use loudspeakers. It's stirred great passion, and it's been provoked by tweets from a popular musician called Sonu Nigam. Our correspondent Rahul Tandon told me about him.
He's fairly big. Sonu Nigam is a household name here in India. He's been a popular singer, playback singer in the Bollywood industry for quite a long period of time. I think some people here who are not his fans may accuse him of noise pollution with some of the songs that he's actually done over the last decade or so. He woke up one morning and then took to social media, as I suppose a lot of people do. And in one tweet, he basically said, I'm not a Muslim, so why do I need to be woken up by an azan? He then had a series of tweets after that where he said, look, it's not just about the azan itself. It's also about temples, gurdwaras as well, and the noise pollution that comes from them. But let's have a listen now to the sound that disturbed him.
That sounds like the call to prayer, is that right?
That is correct. That is the Muslim call to prayer, which was coming from a mosque that was close to his flat, which annoyed him because he said it woke him up in the morning. And he said, when will this forced religiousness end here in India? And it's prompted a huge debate over the course of the last 10 days or so about noise pollution. We had a cleric from Kolkata who basically said that Sonu Nigam's comments were against the constitution and that he should be asked to leave this country. He also said he would give a reward if somebody shaved all the hair off his head. Sonu Nigam then shaved the hair off his head himself and said, can I get the reward? But I think there's a serious question here. I mean, you can hear now that it's a fairly noisy street that I'm on, that there's a mosque on it, there's a temple on it. If you go a little bit further down, there's a church on it as well. There's a lot of noise, there's a lot of sound here. But I think there is a debate now about the noise that comes from religious institutions, because many of them, I can see in front of me, have loud speakers outside them. And when it's time to pray, whatever faith you are from, it can be extremely loud.
Just separating the question of religion from the question of noise for a moment, it is, as you say, and we can hear, a noisy old place. Is there much sympathy for him on that score?
I think that there is, actually. I think there's a lot of sympathy. I think the issue of noise pollution, whether it's traffic, whether it's prayers, whether it's horns, which there's a lot of here in India, is something that people do want to have tackled. And I think, you know, horns and loudspeakers have something in common at the moment. We see many religious institutions, in a sense, to show their importance, putting louder and louder speakers outside themselves to almost say, look, we're more important than the temple down the road because we have a bigger speaker. We're more important than the next mosque because we have a bigger speaker for the call to prayers. I've been out on the streets of Kolkata asking people if they have much sympathy for Sonu Nigam. This is what they said.
Oh, yes, it's very annoying, and I think so there should be a total ban, whether it's coming from a temple or a mosque.
The decibel level is an issue. It is an assumption by certain factions and certain sections of the society taking it on themselves that it is an affront to them. I don't think it was meant to be an affront to a particular section of the society. It was meant in general that decibel levels do hurt people.
I live close to a mosque. For me, it certainly is. So I think it's definitely an issue, and he was completely right in what he said.
On the other hand, Rahul, it sounds from what you say as if there are also those who feel that religion should be exempt from this kind of criticism, that religion's different and set apart.
Yeah, I think there are many people who would hold that view here because it is such an important part of the culture of this country. I think another interesting aspect of what we've seen in the debate that came from a tweet that a Bollywood singer posted in a bit of annoyance early in the morning is the debate about religion here itself, I think, that we're seeing is growing and growing and growing. I think there's more sensitivity amongst all faiths about debate of any aspect of them.
Rahul, Tandon. There have been two resignations by senior doctors at the National Maternity Hospital in Dublin over plans to hand ownership of the hospital to an order of nuns who ran some of Ireland's notorious Magdalene laundries for young women and who still haven't paid their full share towards a compensation scheme for abuse victims. Patsy McGarry is the religious affairs correspondent of the Irish Times, and I asked him about the order.
The Sisters of Charity is one of the oldest native Irish female congregations, religious congregations, founded in the 17th century by a woman called Mary Aikenhead, who set up some schools and hospitals in Dublin City in the early 1800s. But they also ran residential institutions for children and were investigated by the Ryan Commission, which reported in 2009 and was quite critical of their treatment of children in their care. They were part of a redress scheme. The Sisters of Charity agreed to pay an additional €5 million, of which they had paid €2 million. And in that context, it emerged that the new National Maternity Hospital, which is to be built to replace the one that exists in Hollow Street in Dublin now in the city centre, is to be located on a site owned by the Sisters of Charity at their hospital in St. Vincent's Hospital, and that they would own the new hospital because they are supplying that site. And this caused a furore in the context of their non-payment, as believed, to redress, their role in running a residential institution for children, the fact also that they had been running Magdalene laundries and had refused to contribute to a redress fund for women who were in those laundries as young women.
Well, given that background, it's quite difficult to see why anyone thought it was a good idea to give them control of this hospital.
Well, there's great public disquiet since it emerged that the Sisters of Charity will now own this new maternity hospital, not least in the context of the Catholic Church's very, very strict teachings to do with reproduction and human fertility. I mean, the Sisters of Charity have guidelines on this matter, whereby there's to be no IVF treatments, no sterilizations, of course no contraception, certainly no abortions, even in the limited context in which they're allowed currently in the Republic of Ireland. And it looks like we'll have another referendum on abortion next year, which appears anyhow likely to liberate the abortion laws in the Republic even further. So this new maternity hospital, if it is operated according to a Catholic ethos, which would be expected in a building owned by a Catholic religious congregation, will not be allowed to perform procedures which would be legal in the state then.
What does this tell us about the relationship between government and the church in Ireland? It suggests that despite all the knocks the church has taken over the past few years, it's still quite close.
Well, it's the way things were done, if you like, in the past and up to now. And I mean, people didn't think to question it until very, very recently. And really, because the redress issue became an issue last month, it probably would have gone through or would have sailed through. It was the fact that the state has incurred costs of €1.5 billion in redress to people who are in institutions run by 18 religious congregations, including the Sisters of Charity, that it has given this story such an acute edge just now, that the Sisters of Charity will own a building which is being constructed by the state at a cost of €300 million at a time when the state is already paying out €1.5 billion in redress to people who've been in institutions run by the congregations, including the Sisters of Charity.
What are the nuns saying about it all?
Very little. The healthcare group has issued some statements, and as far as they're concerned, all is peaceful once again, but it wouldn't appear to be the case where the public is concerned.
So what do you think is going to happen next?
I do not think that it is over at all yet. Peter Boylan, the former master of the National Maternity Hospital, has come out very strongly against it. The former master of another maternity hospital in Dublin, the Coombe, has come out very strongly against it, and he's involved with the project itself. So I think there will be growing opposition to the current plan as it stands. The issue of ownership will have to be resolved either through a long-term lease or the nuns handing over the site to the state or the state taking it over under a compulsory purchase order.
Patsy McGarry. The choir of Caius College, Cambridge, singing Non Moriar Sed Vivam, I Shall Not Die But Live, which is thought to have been composed by Martin Luther. The 500th anniversary of the Reformation is being marked in all sorts of ways, and for our colleagues on Radio 3, it's an opportunity to look at the relationship between that great theological and intellectual revolution and music. Lucy Winkett, the rector of St James's Piccadilly in London, trained as a singer before her ordination, and she's been to the German town of Torgau, home to Martin Luther's colleague Johann Walter, for more than 20 years.
The first purpose-built Lutheran church is not in Wittenberg, where Luther's said to have posted his 95 theses, but here in Torgau, within the walls of the Hartenfels Castle, once a centre for court music. Johann Walter was a musician at the court. He set many of Luther's hymns to music, and together the two men wrote the first German Mass. I met inside the church by tour guide Judith Henke, who explained how its design reflects Lutheran theology.
So Luther had the idea of having a church following his ideas. So he wanted to have a church as a plain room where the word of God is in the middle. And so this church was built, and Luther consecrated it from that pulpit on October the 5th in 1544.
So I'm just looking around the church now. What's striking, there's an altar, but above the altar, it's not a crucifix.
No. Music plays a very important role in Luther's church.
It's a huge organ. I mean, it's right in the sight lines of everybody watching.
Yeah. Luther said, you preach the gospel and you can sing the gospel. And so everybody can understand the words more easily. And it was German. Yeah, so his friend, Johann Walter, and he together, they wrote the first Protestant songbook.
Aus tiefer Not, Out of the Depths I Cry to You, is one of Luther's most famous hymns, set to music by Johann Walter, who taught music and Latin at the local high school.
The word of God was spread with the help of music, and that's why you have to teach children. And you have to teach them the word of God, you have to teach them the music, so that they can spread the music onto the next generations, and therefore it is important to teach it at school. Johann Walter is also called the Urkantor, so he was the first to link church and school and with the help of education.
And in that spirit, I love the fact that you're a tour guide for the town and for the church, and you're also a teacher in the school.
Yeah, so you see, that link is for eternity.
Appropriately today, the school that bears Johann Walter's name boasts a fine choir, singing here a 16th century song, as Luther did, in praise of Frau Musica. I was joined in Torgau by music scholar Michael Mall to reflect on the reformers' strategy of spreading their message through music.
That happened in a very clever way. Philip Melanchthon, close friend of Luther, he came up in 1528 with new official school regulations for entire Saxony. And here it was said that in the school syllabus, music has to play an extraordinary role, 4 hours per week in every school, not only for the boys, also for the girls. And these choirs, consisting of the boys from the school, practice hymns and motets for the Sunday service.
How fast did this spread? What was the pace of it?
Amazingly fast, because there was a second pillar for this amazing development, that was this idea of the cantorei. The cantorei consisting of adult amateur singers also did musical practice once a week to present it later in the Sunday service. That was an idea that was copied in all the other central German towns. So within the next 40, 50 years, everywhere such cantorais for adult singers were founded, and many of them still exist, actually. They have a tradition of nearly 500 years. When Walter realized that it is really hard to motivate these people to show up in the rehearsals, Luther and also the Torgau Town Council invited the members of the cantorei, sometimes four times a year, to a very amazing feast meal. And people from all sections of the society wanted to try to get in these cantoreis. I have the impression these were the golf clubs of the Protestant 16th century in a way.
Michael Mal, ending that report by Lucy Winkett. And you can hear her full documentary this evening on Radio 3 at 6:45. It's part of its Reformation season, which runs all week. Time's just after 7:30. You're listening to Sunday. Still to come in the programme, how revelations about the Jehovah's Witnesses' response to child abuse allegations in America and Australia have prompted calls for an investigation into their practices here. Pope Francis is back in Rome after his two-day trip to Cairo. Our religious affairs correspondent Martin Bashir was with him. And Martin, we should probably talk first, actually, about the news that he's created since leaving, his comments on his plane back to Rome about North Korea. He used really very strong language, didn't he?
He did. Good to join you, Ed. The question was framed on the plane in part by the speech that Pope Francis gave on the first day of his visit on Friday, when he addressed the historic Al-Azhar University in Cairo. And in that speech, he said these words: "Demagogic forms of populism are on the rise. These certainly do not help to consolidate peace and stability." And so an American journalist on the plane asked Pope Francis about the anxiety and fear that he said is being spread around the world by North Korea's continued ballistic missile testing and Kim Jong-un's public belligerence. The Pope began by saying that if any of these weapons were used in a military conflict, a good part of humanity would be destroyed. He said, maybe not half, but a good part. He said that he personally was deeply concerned about a situation that he said has recently become, in his words again, too hot. He then went on, if I may say so respectfully, in a somewhat staccato fashion, suggesting that the response to any kind of potential military conflict is always mediation, a diplomatic solution. And he then suggested that Norway might be a good mediator in these circumstances. He didn't mention the role of Norway, of course, in the mid-1990s when they brokered an agreement between Israel and the Palestinians that became known as the Oslo Accords. The Pope was then asked if the Trump administration had been in contact. And since Donald Trump is expected to attend a summit in Sicily towards the end of this month, and he answered by saying he had not yet been told if President Trump was going to pay a visit to the Vatican. So I don't think this was a planned strategic intervention by Pope Francis on the tensions surrounding North Korea. It was more a repetition of something that he's oftentimes repeated in theological and political contexts, that dialogue is always preferable to conflict.
Well, that brings us, I suppose, to the visit itself. Takes place or took place in the aftermath of those dreadful attacks on Coptic churches on Palm Sunday. Is it regarded as a success?
Well, you're right, Ed. Cairo is a challenging environment for any Christian leader. When President Sisi announced a three-month state of emergency following those twin bomb attacks on Palm Sunday, it was almost an acknowledgement that the persecution and murder of Christians in Egypt had become a near quarterly occurrence. And for Pope Francis, this visit had two clear motivations. First, he wanted to console and support Christians in their suffering. His second motivation was to continue his commitment to interreligious dialogue, most specifically with Islam. And so on the first day of his short visit, as I said, he spoke at the historic Al-Azhar University and said this: "Let us once more say a firm and clear no to every form of violence, vengeance and hatred carried out in the name of religion or in the name of God. Together, let us affirm the incompatibility of violence and faith, belief and hatred." He didn't name so-called Islamic State, But since they claimed to be behind the bomb attacks on Palm Sunday, it was pretty obvious who he was referring to. Interestingly, I interviewed several members of the mostly Muslim audience, and here's how one gentleman responded to the Pope's speech.
A man of peace. A man of peace. Egyptians respect this man because of his speeches about Islam, because he's a respectable man.
Martin, what about his meeting with President al-Sisi? Because there were questions about how far he might go in terms of pushing his concerns about human rights in that meeting.
Yes, as you might expect, Ed, we were not allowed any access to the Pope's meeting with President Sisi. We were given a readout a few hours after it had taken place, and it was reported to us that President Sisi emphasised to the Pope that he wanted Egypt to be a model of moderate Islam. He also emphasised that Christian Egyptians are an integral part of the Egyptian national fabric, and claimed that the state treats all Egyptians on the basis of citizenship and constitutional and legal rights, regardless of religious faith. But for Father Henry Boulad, a Jesuit priest from Alexandria, he told me that Christians in Egypt are frankly regarded as inferior to Muslims.
A big step towards peace, on condition that it's built on frankness and truth. Otherwise, they're going to continue this deaf dialogue or kind of monologue which has started 50 years ago and has led to nothing up till now. I don't want to be a second-class citizen in my own country. So as long as the source of inspiration of the Constitution is Islam, I don't feel at home. My country, Egypt, was Christian before being Muslim. So I ask to be at home, and I don't want a religion to prevail over another religion.
And Martin, quick final word. People have often pointed out he's getting on in years. How did he look? How was he on the trip?
I thought he looked going out. I thought he looked energised. Coming back, he was extremely tired. It was a 36-hour visit with no less than 7 addresses.
Yeah, quite something for somebody of his age. Martin, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Should the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse investigate the Jehovah's Witnesses? We're devoting the rest of the programme to a special report on why some campaigners and lawyers think it should. Their calls come after revelations that branches of the religious organisation in Australia and America have kept a database of alleged abusers for decades and that they don't alert the police to any allegations of abuse that they receive. David Cook reports now on what one respected lawyer calls the molestation files that the Jehovah's Witnesses are fighting to keep secret. He begins with the story of Nick French, whose ordeal began when he was 7 years old, and his mother joined the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Not long after my mum became a Jehovah's Witness, she was a single parent by then, she met a male Jehovah's Witness who she subsequently married, but it turns out that he was a paedophile. And even before they got married, he started to groom me, and I underwent physical, mental and sexual abuse.
Nick's abuse continued for 5 years. Even though he was going to the local school, he says he was unable to tell anyone what was happening to him because of the religion's teaching about the outside world.
Anything outside the world of Jehovah's Witnesses is an evil place. You would go to school because the state says that you're to go to school. You certainly wouldn't be involved in anything out with the group because it's under the control of Satan the devil. And you would just limit any association with people outside of the organisation.
Globally, there are around 8 million Jehovah's Witnesses. The largest number are in America, where the Watchtower, the organisation's headquarters, is based. Being a Jehovah's Witness is a way of life for everyone, and you're expected to follow all doctrines issued by the governing body.
Life doesn't only just revolve around it. That is your family. That is your spiritual family. That's all you know, growing up.
Candace Conte was also abused by Jehovah's Witness. Years later, she discovered that senior members of the congregation knew he was a convicted child abuser.
Jonathan Kendrick was a member of our congregation. He had a way of being very forceful and seemed to take a really big liking to the kids in the congregation. And he ended up molesting me over a course of a couple years. And, you know, I think at that point in time, I was too afraid to really say anything. There was a lot of turmoil in my own family. And I was scared.
Eventually, Candace and Nick found the strength to ask for help to stop the abuse. But when they went to the senior leaders in charge of the congregation, this is what happened.
I did speak to my mum, who spoke to the elders within the congregation on several occasions, but because of the fact that there was no other witness to what was going on, and it was my word against his, nothing was done about it.
I pretty much got shut down. I was talking to a brick wall, and the first and foremost, they had said that before we're going to even listen to what you say, you know, you need to tell us what happened, and we need to prove that it happened to you in the first place. At that point, that was when the two-witness rule that you may hear a lot about came out.
The two-witness rule comes from Scripture, according to Jehovah's Witnesses, that you can't ruin somebody's reputation or throw them in prison simply because one person made an accusation. So you need more than one witness, hence the two-witness rule.
This is Trey Bundy. He's from the Center for Investigative Reporting in the United States, and he's also been trying to break through the wall of secrecy built up by the Jehovah's Witnesses.
When somebody comes forward with an allegation of child abuse, if there are not two witnesses to that crime, the Jehovah's Witness elders don't do anything about it. And they say, basically, we're going to leave this in the hands of Jehovah. The problem is, child abuse almost never happens in public or in front of witnesses. So most of these cases go uninvestigated, even within the organization.
Having been a father of an abuse victim, it has come to my notice that this is not an isolated case. In fact, the more we look into it, the more that we realise that child abuse amongst Jehovah's Witnesses is at an epidemic level.
John Viney was a Jehovah's Witness for 50 years and served as an elder, a pastoral leader, for much of that time. Like many of the people I've spoken to, he stresses that the vast majority of Jehovah's Witnesses are good, honest people. But when it comes to investigating allegations of child abuse, elders do not have the proper skills. John left the organisation after his daughter Karen was abused by an elder.
They are not trained to deal with it. There is no training to deal with such things. You try to be loving and kind and understanding, and you would hope that. And that is true. Elders are encouraged to be good listeners. But as for helping abuse victims, whether they need psychological help, whether they need help in removing them from the bad situation that they're in, we were never qualified to deal with that.
According to the Jehovah's Witnesses' own child safeguarding policy for the UK that was published in January this year, when an allegation of child abuse is made, elders are instructed to call the Bethel, the organisation's headquarters in London, and ask to speak to the legal department for advice. The policy says that they do not condone child abuse under any circumstances. They also consider it to be a serious crime and a sin, and say that anyone committing it would face expulsion from the congregation. Yet there is no direct instruction to report the allegation to the police. This isn't illegal. There is currently no legislation in the UK for the mandatory reporting of allegations of child sex abuse.
You're not going to get Jehovah's Witnesses going to law enforcement and reporting. It's much more uncommon than it is otherwise.
Erwin Zolkin is based in California. His law firm has filed over 20 child sexual abuse cases against the Jehovah's Witnesses. He's fighting to change how reports of abuse are handled by the leadership of the organisation. Erwin's been trying to get access to a database of alleged abusers that the Watchtower started in the late 1990s.
It stems from a letter written in March of 1997 to all these elders throughout the United States to produce very detailed reports regarding these known molesters. So they have this information. We know they have this information.
Erwin Zolkin went to court and requested the disclosure of all reports of child sexual abuse made to the organisation. After a long legal battle, he was sent some of the records in the database, but he can't tell anyone what he has received. He can't even share the files that are locked in his office with the police.
I have an order of protection from the Superior Court of San Diego of California instructing that I can't talk about what I've got. I can tell you that I have 4 years' worth of records that relate to known sexual abusers within the Jehovah's Witnesses who were in positions of authority. There are 20 years' worth of records that we have requested, and the documents that have been provided to us are very heavily redacted. So, for example, the names of the perpetrators have been removed, the towns, the congregation names. So we can't do much with that. We can't track, for example, if you have a perpetrator in a particular congregation that has then moved. Has he reoffended somewhere? We can't tell because we don't have his name.
And it's not just in the United States that the Jehovah's Witnesses have been forced to hand over information. In Australia, the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses into Child Sexual Abuse held a hearing into the organisation. The case report, published in October last year, was highly critical of the organisation's safeguarding policies and practices, including the two-witness rule we heard about earlier. Documents showed that since the 1950s, there could be as many as 1,800 victims of child sexual abuse in Australia. The organisation also knew of over 1,000 alleged abusers, and they admitted to the Royal Commission that not one of them was reported to the police. If such evidence exists in Australia and the United States, what information does the Bethel, the London headquarters of the Jehovah's Witnesses, hold here in Britain? Lawyer Irwin Zolkin and former elder John Viney are convinced that a database of alleged and known abusers is being held.
I know it does. I've spoken to Jehovah's Witness elders within the last couple of weeks to confirm what they have to do if a matter of child abuse comes into their knowledge. There are particular forms that have to be filled out. Some of these now are done electronically, so not necessarily on paper. Even someone that is accused of child abuse, their name and their actions has to be relayed to Bethel so that Bethel keep these on file. They do that because if the abuser was to move to another congregation, at least they would have a record of that. So there is absolutely no doubt that within the Bethel in London, they have what I know would be thousands of names.
I think it absolutely exists. I don't think this is a policy that's just limited to the United States. I think that for the same reasons that they've demanded to have this information in the United States, they would require it in all of what they call their branches, which is wherever they have Jehovah's Witnesses. I call it a crisis of silence. And that's a policy that needs to change.
Lawyers here know that any attempt to get access to information held by the Jehovah's Witnesses will be time-consuming and expensive. In 2014, the Charity Commission launched investigations into the Manchester New Mostyn congregation and the UK headquarters of the organisation. They wanted to look at their safeguarding policies and check how they manage child abuse allegations. Harvey Grenville, the Charity Commission's head of investigations, says it was a frustrating experience.
These investigations have unfortunately been met by protracted litigation in five different courts. We accept that charities can, of course, pursue challenges to some of the decisions that we've made, but this level of litigation has been unprecedented and has frustrated the pace of our investigations. This is something that we regret, not least because of the public and charity funds involved.
With a reputation as aggressive litigants, campaigners and lawyers are calling on the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse here in the UK to formally launch an investigation into the Jehovah's Witnesses.
The thing that is particularly significant about the Jehovah's Witnesses is that they are continuing the practices that they have been following for decades.
Laura Hoyano is a barrister and an associate law professor at the University of Oxford. She has an international reputation for academic research in all criminal, civil and human rights aspects of child abuse. She says there are compelling reasons for the Independent Inquiry to launch an immediate investigation.
the Jehovah's Witnesses have not had that recent revelation, if you like, and openness. They are continuing their practices, and therefore it is, in my view, vital that the independent inquiry look at their organization and how they deal with child abuse of all forms in order to appreciate how closed institutions operating today in our current public safeguarding environment are still able to conceal what is happening to these children.
We've heard how effective the Jehovah's Witnesses are at stalling the production of data, of information that could be useful to an inquiry. Do we need the independent inquiry into child sex abuse here in the UK to formally open a module, as you call it, into the Jehovah's Witnesses for the production of that information that's held at the Bethel here in the UK?
Yes, definitely. That is going to be by far the most effective way of doing it. And I think that the inquiry has got the powers to require production of those documents. And I understand that they have already taken some steps to ensure that the documents will be retained and not destroyed.
In a statement, the independent inquiry told us,
"We are not able to say at this time whether or not there will be a specific investigation into matters relating to the Jehovah's Witnesses in the future, but there will be ways in which we take into consideration information relating to this institution when carrying out our work."
12 individuals listened to the story of my life that, you know, I hadn't told many people, and they proved them guilty.
In 2011, Candace Conte took the Jehovah's Witnesses to court. A jury awarded her a $28 million verdict after it was shown that the organisation told no one that her abuser had a previous conviction for child abuse. Nick's abuser received a 10-year prison sentence. Candace and Nick are no longer Jehovah's Witnesses.
When my family found out that I was no longer a Jehovah's Witness, they decided to shun me. I received an email from my mum to say this will be the last communication that we have. Sadly, I no longer have a relationship with my mother, my brother, my sister, their children. I assume they live in the same areas that I knew a few years ago, but they may well have moved. As far as they're concerned, I'm dead to them.
Child abuse is not an epidemic. It's a pandemic. It's everywhere. So what can we do to bring the transparency to these organizations to achieve a goal of protecting children? But it's also kind of opened the door for what reforms can we go into now? You know, what can we do now?
People listening to this who may have their own experiences and may be contemplating going to authorities, when the stakes appear from the inside to be so high, what's your advice to people?
Be strong and have courage. It's terrible what happened to you. It's terrible. But think about the children that don't have protection. You know, because you lived through it. So be strong and have courage and try to stand up. And it's tough. It's hard. I'm not going to deny that. But the only way that we're going to get change is if you have a voice. So have a voice.
That report from David Cook. The Jehovah's Witnesses declined to take part in this programme. They gave us a statement instead. They said Jehovah's Witnesses abhor child abuse and view it as a heinous crime and sin. They went on, the safety of our children is of utmost importance, and the victim and his or her parents have the absolute right to report the matter to the governmental authorities. Whether the victim or parents decide to report the matter is not contingent on the number of witnesses to the offence or whether a confession has been made. They also say congregation elders do not shield abusers from the authorities or from the consequences of their actions. Anyone who commits the sin of child abuse faces expulsion from the congregation. That's it for this week's Sunday. Do email us, sunday@bbc.co.uk, or write to us, Dockhouse Media City UK, Salford M50 2LH. I shall be back in this chair next weekend. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.